Hello, friends, and welcome to Backstory. I'm your host, Alex Roberts. Remember that I will be at Big Bad Con this weekend, running a 10-table star-crossed wide con called Space Station Phobolex, as well as my new card-based storytelling game, For the Queen. You can also catch me doing a couple shifts at the Tell Me About Your Character booth, raising money for Doctors Without Borders. Donate $5 and you can tell me all about your half-orc bard or whatever you feel like. Honestly, I'm probably going to be pretty fascinated by it, so it's a good deal. You can find out more at bigbadcon.com. I will also be at Metatopia the first weekend of November. I'll have more details for you next episode, but you can go to dexposure.com to find out more. My guest today is podcaster and game designer Jeff Stormer. You might know him from his two-player actual play podcast, Party of One, or his upcoming Super Spies in Corporate Meetings game, Mission Accomplished. However, what I'm most concerned about is his status as the unofficial LARP designer of the Olive Garden chain of restaurants. Let's jump in.
Good. My friend had a bachelor party on Saturday.
Oh, nice.
That was fun. On Friday, Friday I worked from home. I claimed that I was sick, but it was secretly I wanted to go to a wrestling show at a brewery with my wife.
Okay.
And it was amazing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to ask you about some LARPs that you've expressed a lot of enjoyment for. I don't know if I can say they're your favorite LARPs, but I have a few made note of here. And number one, professional wrestling.
Yes, of course. The world's oldest and some would say most financially successful LARP.
Definitely most financially successful. Yeah. So you have like a local promotion that you go and see?
We have a few local promotions that we go and see. But one of this one is there's a brewery, a craft beer brewery near us that last year put on a wrestling show, and this year they put on like the sequel wrestling event, and now it's seeming like they're going to be doing this fairly regularly. And it's not like a great show, it's not the most like thrilling or exciting show, but it is just it's very simple wrestling done very well. It's the kind where like I can sit down and as soon as somebody comes out I can go, okay, so then I can go, okay, so the next person's going to do this, and then they're going to kind of go back and forth, and the match is going to go ba ba ba. And I'm pretty much right. Like, I pretty much get it right, because they're not trying to, like, break the mold. They're just like, this is how wrestling is. And there's a quaint and kind of beautiful quality to that, of this particular promotion just being like, yeah, this is what we do, you know? This is what you get. And it's well-performed. But it's predictable, but not in a bad way.
Mm-hmm. I think wrestling really succeeds on its sort of broadness, like on being instantly legible and like, I don't know, kind of unchallenging in a way.
Yeah, I think it's really a beautiful, I think that's part of the beauty of it is that like those qualities kind of translate to probably more, like the big picture thing that I've been thinking about a lot in the last few months as my wife and I have been watching a lot of like Japanese wrestling and lucha libre is that wrestling is, you know, to your point about it being kind of unchallenging and very legible, it's kind of an international language in a way that sort of like when you really start to think about it is kind of mind-blowing and chokes me up a little bit.
What do you mean by that? Tell me more.
I've watched a lot of wrestling, particularly international wrestling, and I've listened to podcasts and interviews with wrestlers who have gone to other countries. And you hear a lot of stories about like, I don't speak, you know, my opponent and I don't speak the same language. You know, I don't speak Japanese. He does not speak English. But they're like the two wrestlers are able to put together really incredible, like incredible, fun, engaging, captivating matches because they know wrestling. They know if I hit the ropes and run at you and you duck down, that means you're either going to hit me with a back body drop, I'm going to pick you up for a power bomb. There are only so many things I can do off of that maneuver. And so even if we're not planning things in advance and we're acting on the fly, there's a certain quality that, like, we don't have to speak the same language because we have learned these common rituals and common movements that we can improvise out this match, create this piece of art based solely on, like, our understanding of these sort of artistic beats. That's kind of beautiful. Like, there's a real... It's not kind of beautiful. It's just there's the beauty to that of, like, being able to find this very kind of strange art form as this thing that transcends, like, verbal and written language and can be understood by anyone, anywhere, anytime.
Right. If you speak it, so to speak.
Yeah. Yeah. There's something to that that I'm fascinated by.
I think something that is actually super relevant for LARP is this idea of, like, nonverbal communication. Mm-hmm. And the idea of, you know, saying one thing as your character while saying a separate thing as a player, you know, like, yeah. Your character can be saying, you know, oh, I sure hope nobody surprises me with, you know, whatever, whatever. But then you as a player can be like, oh, that would be some really good play. Someone should totally do that. And there's ways that you can kind of say that, like, with your eyes or with your hands. I mean, or you can just drop completely out of character and be like, oh, for real, though, that would be awesome.
I think kind of the simplest example of that is wrestling is an art form that asks you to boo if something is going well. If somebody is doing their job well, like, wrestling is an art form that says, hey, if you're really, really liking this, tell me I suck. Tell me you hate me and that you want me to go home.
Right. And that's the only way that they know, like, okay, good, I'm nailing it. Everyone is booing me intensely.
Everyone is throwing trash at me and threatening me. And, like, that tells me that I am doing the best job.
I wonder what it feels like to be doing that translation, especially if you're, like, if you're a heel for a long time. Like, is it something that you just kind of have to love and be into? Or, I don't know, does that take a toll on people after a while?
I have heard reports that, like, you have to kind of have a particular you have to be able to kind of, like, compartmentalize it a little bit. Like, I've heard people talk about how it's not something that everyone can do because some people have a hard, like, I know that, like, I have a hard time, even if it's just, like, a Twitter joke, playing that role of, like, that role and being the bad guy, because, like, the idea of somebody being, you know, upset, I get very sensitive about it. And the few times I've kind of been in sort of the orbit of wrestling, it is difficult for me to take that role and be that person. And so I've heard people be like, yeah, I can't really do it. And then there's certain people that are like, no, like, if someone is booing me, that means that they care enough about my work to have this visceral reaction. So they take it as, like, a point of praise. And, like, they're like, I'm doing my job well. If they are that invested, then that means I have given them something. I've given them a piece of art that moves them so much that this is how they react. Basically, what's better than that? And it kind of varies depending on how you approach, like, how you picture what you're after in wrestling.
Totally. And there's also, if you can get into the recognition that the audience themselves is also playing a role, right? Like, when I boo at a wrestling show, which I haven't gone to in a while, but there was one, there was a promotion in Ottawa I really enjoyed. Like, when I boo, I'm saying, like, hell yeah. Like, I am booing with delight.
And there's a body language to that, right? Like, it's like you were saying, like, you say that with your eyes and your body, that even if you're booing, you convey to performers, like, I'm invested, I'm here, I'm experiencing this. And I think there's an element of, like, yeah, there's that element of I am telling you that I care about what's happening by telling you that I'm angry at you.
Is wrestling kind of a morality play?
Kind of. It's very... I've watched, you know, it's very good versus evil, and it's very much the thing that I think is interesting about it from that perspective is it's very based on what you do. There, I think, like, forgiveness is surprisingly prevalent an idea in professional wrestling in a way that you wouldn't expect based on the idea that it is all about violence and all about, like, acting out your frustrations. It's an art form that very much says, like, what you do matters. If you do something to hurt someone or to break a rule or to cheat, you are bad. You are a bad person. But even if you have done this for a very long time, you are never so far gone that if you do the right thing and you help someone and you stand by the rules and you follow the contracts that we have all kind of laid out, the social contracts, you can be cheered. You can be good. And I'm just now in this conversation realizing like how sort of strangely wonderful that is. Like that kind of perspective of like, you can do anything. And if you do the, you know, you are never so far gone that you are beyond redemption, that beyond that sort of face turn into heroism. But you have to put in the work and do the thing to make things right.
And that appeals to people on two levels, right? There's the, you know, the bad things that I have done may be forgiven, but there's also like the people who have wronged me or the people I care about who I have hurt others, that there's the chance that they may turn it around. Like that latter thing is even more compelling somehow.
It's unexpectedly beautiful. Like you don't quite, it, like it's something that just kind of is much like a lot of wrestling. And this is one of the things that fascinates me about it. That's just kind of part of the thing. And it's never really like explicitly laid out or talked about. We all just kind of, if you're at a wrestling show, you kind of just pick up through like osmosis that is the way that this particular world, this particular LARP operates.
Yeah, that's one of the things I'm most interested in about it is from an experience design perspective, there's very little that you have to convey verbally to the audience, to the who are essentially the participants, right? Like you don't walk into a wrestling show and there's a big sign outside that's like, this guy is good, this guy is bad. Please go to this website and read 1,000 pages of lore so you can understand why. And when this happens, do this. Here are the key themes you're going to be approaching. Like when someone steps out, you know instantly if they're a good guy or a bad guy. And you know instantly from that person and from everyone around you how you should be reacting.
Yeah, I have sent my friends 1,000-word like lore packages when they consider like if they're going to a show that I care about, like they've been like, so what's the deal here? And I'm like, oh, let me tell you, I have so many details. But you're exactly right. You sit down and somebody comes out and the crowd just boos. And you're like, oh, why are we booing? And then they do something like they yell at a kid in the crowd. That kid gets scared and starts to cry. And then you're like, well, that man yelled at a child. Of course I will boo this man. And then that immediately triggers the fact that when the next person comes out and gives that kid a lollipop, you're like, oh, well, good. Yes, thank you. Thank you for giving that child a lollipop. I will applaud that. So does everyone else in the room. And you collectively just are put in that world in those circumstances. And you're right. There's no guide of like, hey, when this happens, boo. And like, I've thought about this a lot in regards to like chance, you know, that people go to wrestling shows and they just know what to, you know, you hear people will just chant things. And I'm like, where did this start? Like there are very specific chants that have gone on my entire life. And I'm like, I don't know where this chant came from. But you know it. People in the room know the chant and they chant it. And then anybody who doesn't know the chant hears people chanting and joins in. And suddenly this piece of the experience just virally spreads through virtue of, oh, well, someone else did it at a show I was at. They did it at this moment. So I guess that's how it works. And it just exists. It's beautiful. It's beautiful.
Gosh darn.
I love wrestling.
Wrestling is so fun and cool and strange.
It's weird. It's a weird art form.
Yo, did I tell you I went to a pro wrestling show at a con in Finland at Ropacon? Shout out to Ropacon.
No, you did not tell me this. And I am, this is amazing.
They do this like every year. They have for like a couple of years now at Ropacon. And when someone first suggested it, they were like, at our LARP show, I don't get it. Okay, sure. But now it's like a cherished annual event and like it's packed to the gills in there.
I've been lucky enough. I refereed, there's a small promotion that runs like a few like comic and anime conventions around my area that I was lucky enough to, I do commentary for them sometimes, and I referee like once in a blue moon. And it was the coolest experience just looking around. And the way the convention center, it was the Atlantic City Convention Center. It was cosplay pro wrestling. So the whole stick is that they are wrestling in costumes as other characters. And so it's an anime convention, and the way the Atlantic City Convention Center is set up like Roman gladiator style, where there's big open, it's like there's the central kind of like courtyard area, and then open hallways, and people were just lining these open hallways. And like, just looking at it, I was like, this is like, just visually speaking, was the weirdest and coolest thing I've I love wrestling. I really, really like wrestling is the thing.
Okay, so what is your actual role as the referee in a wrestling match? Because they're obviously there to break the rules. Do you just identify when that happens? Are you controlling the pacing? Like, what are you actually doing?
First and foremost, you are like an actor on the stage, right? Like, I am there to count the pin so the audience knows, oh, the match is over. Great. I'm there to count the pinfall so the audience can get invested when somebody does a big move. They're like, one, two, oh. You need a visual marker of that to kind of furthering the idea of like nonverbal communication. Somebody has to be there to tell the audience in a nonverbal way, hey, this could be the end of the match. Just kidding. We're going to keep going. Also, the referee is there to help direct the story to the wrestlers in case like things get off kilter or people go off script, to be like, hey, it's been 12 minutes. We are scheduled to end the match now. Do your finisher and like go home. And then also to basically like, if word comes from most referees, I did not have an earpiece, but you'll see a lot of referees wear earpieces so that the creative, like the producers or the booker or whomever is like scripting out the match, if something happens, they can like tell you and be like, hey, we're changing it because this person got stuck in traffic. We need you to tell the wrestlers that the other person has to win. And so you're sort of the liaison person between backstage and the wrestlers to be like, you know, there's the great thing where like a heel will do something illegal and then get in the referee's face and yell at each other.
Oh.
That a lot of times is the referee being like, all right, you got two minutes. We got to do this, this, and this. Make sure you target their knee so that when they come out later, people are surprised because their knee is hurt. Get out there. And like, there's a lot of like that sort of conveying, helping the wrestlers remember where they have to be in the story and what has to happen for the match to make sense. So you're a LARP facilitator at that point. You are there to facilitate the rules and convey the story to the players.
Yeah, completely. And I know a lot of larger LARPs will have like kind of a central story hub and then some GMs or some NPCs or whatever they call them, depending on the LARP, sort of going around and administering rules and administering plot over a really large space. And I bet those people would love to have ear pierce. I bet those people would love to have ear. How come I can't say the word earpieces?
I bet those people would love to have earpieces is how I feel about it. That's a Jeff Stormer thought that I just said just now.
Let's just leave all this in. It's endearing. The audience will love it. Okay. I truly hate to tear us away from professional wrestling because I feel like we could go on.
We could. I could talk about this forever.
Yeah, for literal ever. But LARP number two that you seem very keen on, karaoke.
I love karaoke. And
tell me about your love for karaoke.
It's hard to put into words. Like, karaoke, I can put into words my love of wrestling because I have at length to people. Karaoke, it's harder to, like, capture what it is that makes it so captivating to me. It's this strangely egalitarian approach to being on stage and to performing where we all accept the person that we're going to watch perform might not be a classically trained singer. They might not hit the notes of the song that they have agreed to perform for us, but we're going to encourage them anyway because they're doing something that as a culture just flat out is scary and vulnerable, and it's this There's a sense of real palpable support to it when it's at its best. I think there are people that undercut this by being like snarky or rude to people. And if you're doing that, stop it because it's the worst. But like, I think at its best, there's this element of I'm going to go on stage and sing a song that means enough to me that I want to be holding a microphone in front of a room full of, you know, friends or strangers or whatever and sing this song. It does not matter if I know it. Well, it does not matter if I can hit the notes. I just care enough about this piece of art, whether it's because I think it's funny or because it means something to me. I'm going to sing this. I'm going to bare my heart and sing this thing. And it might not sound the way it's supposed to, but I'm going to do it anyway. And then people are going to say, great, you did a great job. I appreciate you doing that. And like, that's really sweet. Like, there's a sweetness to that that is kind of perfect.
It's that lack of self-consciousness.
Mm-hmm. And it's that we all kind of agree that we're going to have that moment together.
So there's something about, like, I'm trying to get to the heart of this. Is it that suspension of your normal reactions to something like someone getting up and singing slightly off key?
I think so. I think it's that coupled with a certain sense of like breaking the rules of like who is allowed to hold the microphone, to put it a certain way. Like we have expectations of if somebody is going to present something, it must be the best. It must be worthy of our attention. If somebody at an office setting is going to say, I am giving a presentation on this, we expect it to be well researched. If we put on the TV, we expect it to be a well produced thing. Karaoke kind of upends that and says, like, I don't really expect this to be polished. And it kind of makes it kind of that, like, anybody can be a star for a moment. And there's something powerful to that moment, like you said, that casting off of self-consciousness and that casting off of judgment, for lack of a better term, is that casting off of, well, I'm going to expect you to meet certain standards. It's, well, I'm going to expect you to have fun. And I wish more stuff could be like that.
Yeah, completely, right? I think, you know, something that I encounter with a lot of first-time LARPers or like first-time role players at all is that they're very, very concerned with doing a good job and doing it right. And it's I can't disrespect that, you know, because that is the expectation that has been put on them in so many other situations. And I don't know what the signs and signals are to properly express that, like, that's not how it is. That's not what matters at all.
You're here to do something that means something to you. And that's the only metric to be like judged on. And I think that kind of that there's a real common ground there that I think is real prevalent.
Do you feel like you're in a character when you go up to sing karaoke?
Oh, I definitely do. I don't know if my experience is common. It might be. But like, it affects the songs that I sing. It affects like how I perform them. But I think it's probably more common than I would initially say it is. Cause I think it's, you know, I think everyone who does karaoke to a certain extent is not just singing the song, but is playing the character of, if not literally the singer of the song, what we kind of envision as the singer or the character of the song would embody in that moment. You know, like if I go up and sing a Bruce Springsteen song, I am going to affect a certain swagger and a certain, you know, New Jersey hard-earned sentimentality that I think is not something that I necessarily wear in my day-to-day life, but is something that is true to the song. If I want to sing this song, this is how I'm going to portray myself. So yeah, I think so.
So for example, if you, and I should say when you go up and sing Seal's Kiss from a Rose, you know, are you taking on the character of Seal, the man himself, or is there kind of a special version of you that goes up to sing that song?
I think it's more so the latter. And I think part of what makes karaoke so interesting is that once you're karaokeing it, it kind of becomes divorced from that. Like, it becomes, I know when I have and will sing Seal's Kiss from a Rose, because that is a very good karaoke song, I see it not so much as Seal as embodying the Batman, as embodying that spirit of really specifically the Val Kilmer, George Clooney kind of larger than life Batman essence that is within all of us at all times.
Yeah.
And it's that version, it is that version of like, it's, this is me embodying that campy Joel Schumacher sense of excess and of melodrama.
My power, my pleasure, my pain, you know? That's really, that's what you, I was kind of trying to dunk on you a little bit with the Seal question, but you answered it very sincerely, which kind of dunked on me.
I put a lot of sincere thought into Seal's Kiss from a Rose is the thing.
I believe that. I 100% believe that. So if karaoke is like kind of a LARP, you made Empty Orchestra, which is the LARP you play when you're playing karaoke. What does that add to the experience?
I think it kind of uses that kind of emotional experience. So yeah, I think it uses the emotional experience that you're going through of, I want to be doing this thing. It is a vulnerable thing that I am doing. It is performance. It is larger than life. And I am trying to kind of capture a moment of art, basically. And I wrote it very specifically to take that moment and say, what other situations could we see that similar sense of, I am me, but I am more than me. I am putting on a show for people that I don't know, in the hopes that they can feel something beyond themselves. And I thought, and so the crux of the game is very much taking that emotional experience of going on stage, of singing a song, of being vulnerable in front of strangers and saying, well, that's a lot like, for lack of a better term, that's a lot like, you know, activism and like of doing things and of these sort of big, like, important things and saying, okay, so we're going to turn this whole thing into a rock opera and say, because it's a rock opera, you're in a world where rock and roll is outlawed, because of course, and you are going to be the person doing that big dramatic gesture to save the world, because you are doing something so scary and so real that by virtue of singing this song, you are taking those steps that, you know, it's dangerous in this sort of rock opera way that the omnipresent government that has banned music might come and take you away, but it's also scary in that, like, somebody in the crowd might make fun of you, or like that a lady that continually insists that she is in PR and image management continually tells you that you should not sing Total Eclipse of the Heart, despite the fact that I sing Total Eclipse of the Heart very well. And so, like, it's scary. There's that element of fear and vulnerability. There's that element of performance. There's that element of, I need to make myself big such to create the impact that I want to create. And it kind of finds a narrative way to use all of that in a different context. I've wanted to do karaoke at a con for so long, and I cannot find a karaoke bar near any of the convention centers that I go to.
This has to be something that we can overcome. You know, we have the technology. What are your feelings about, like, cobbled together, like, YouTube karaoke where people just sing over the songs? Do you have strong feelings about that?
I feel like you sing how you want to sing. I think that the nice thing about YouTube karaoke is often that if you add karaoke onto the end of it, there is a surprising amount of some fan of a certain song just ripped the vocals out and has put on the instrumental track specifically. So presumably, so they specifically could sing the song in their living room. And it is this form of guerrilla art that I fully endorse.
And then that allows you to connect to that person, which is beautiful.
There's this element of like, yeah, I also really want to sing this song. I also am going to look this up on YouTube. Oh, you've already done this. This is great.
You know, sometimes like people make these incredible games and just toss them up as PDFs, you know, pay what you want or specifically free or something like that. And I'm kind of like blown away, you know, this like really amazing new art form is just like, here you go, everybody. Like, that's awesome. But that's really nothing new on the internet. Like if you spend any amount of time on like even something like YouTube, it's just like someone really just put their heart and soul into something that is in many ways incomprehensible to me. And they've just decided to share it with the world. Like, that's actually the norm of the newest art.
That's what, of all of the things that I dislike about living in the age of the internet, and there are so many, that's the one thing that really, like, gives me so much hope, is that if somebody really wants to do something, the tools to do so, like they can do it and just put it on the internet, and there's a chance that someone will stumble on it, like, 2 years later and say, like, this is my everything. You know, you could... If you want to record a ukulele cover of, of your favorite song, you do that. You put it on YouTube. You might get a YouTube comment like a year later that's like, hey, I like this more than the original, and it really means something to me. And like, what more perfect form of art is, like, what more perfect art experience is that than you've made a thing and it had an impact, and all you did was push publish?
Yeah, it is kind of amazing. And, you know, we could talk forever about the dark side of that, but I feel like lots of other people have already both experienced and described that. But there is something, especially, man, I feel kind of grown up saying this, but like there was a time when it was just kind of, people hadn't really figured out how to monetize anything on the internet. And so everybody was just throwing up like this wild outsider art. You know, whether it was like drawings or whatever. And like, there is just no thought in anyone's mind that there should be some way for them to figure out how to make a living off of this. And so there's, you know, old internet is just this incredible treasure trove of just like stuff that had never been seen before that I don't think enough people appreciated at the time. And certainly not now. I mean, a lot of it has disappeared.
Yeah. I love finding just weird old things on the internet and just like looking at them,
just scoping them out.
You know, Space Jam's website is still out there.
Oh, I'm very familiar with Space Jam's website, a part of our heritage, a treasured, like you know how there's like national historic sites that like you can't touch because they're just such an important part of like this area and its history. Like, that's the Space Jam website. Like, none shall touch it.
I love finding like old, like people's old like fan sites for things, and it barely functions anymore. Half of the images are gone, and it's just like, hey, I really love Captain Planet. Here's my Captain Planet page. And you're just like, yeah, I do love Captain Planet. I've never cared more about Captain Planet than I do in this moment.
And the one or two like super lossy JPEGs that you have put up have really rekindled my love of the captain. Jeff Stormer, did you ever have a fan site? Did you ever make a fan site for anything?
I made a fan site. It was hilariously nonspecific. It was just like, here are the things that I like. And it was like, here's a page on Dungeons and Dragons. Here's some D&D pictures I like. And it was like, here's some DC superheroes with some character art that I found on Google. Really loved the Justice League cartoon. And it was like, I was dead certain that I was going to become like a super celebrity blogger off of this. And then like, I don't even know if it actually made it to a point where anybody could see it because I didn't fully understand web publishing software.
Aww.
But I spent a lot of time making stuff.
Wow. But it was fun, and it's very easy to make things at that time. Like, I remember, like, I must have been in like grade 6 learning HTML and putting stuff up there. And it was so easy to just like scoop the HTML out of some other site and just put it up as your own. Like, everybody did that. What a wild time.
What a time to be alive.
Yeah, for real. An ephemeral, strange time.
Because like, you explain it to someone now and it's just like, you sound incoherent. You sound like you did what?
Yeah. It's like, we had these really, really bad websites and we put garbage on them. It was a good time. And I'm like, oh, okay.
Loved it.
And it's like, now other people have massive websites that they make bajillions of dollars on, and we put garbage on it.
We send out our Degrassi, the next generation live tweets, and that's just all we really do with our days.
There is no world outside the cyber zone. What do you see as the future of role playing?
I had a conversation once ages ago with Hannah Schaefer, and we were talking about something a lot like what we're talking about now. And I think the future is just more of this, which is she had used the phrase. She said, I'm pretty sure we're in the golden age of the weird little role playing game. And I kind of see that as the thing, like the thing. And she had used that term with nothing but affection, and I stand by that term as the purest affection for like the stuff that I like. And what I kind of see that becoming so much more prevalent is just like I have a story, a very specific thing. Like I have a LARP that I want to play at a karaoke bar during only bar karaoke, not room karaoke. I'm going to write it. It's going to be 2 pages. I'm going to put it online, and this and like that's going to exist, and somebody can go off and play that. And I see that as our means of like creating things become more advanced and that bar of expertise lowers and lowers, I see that as being where things continue to head, is like somebody has a very specific game that they want to make. And now I'm recording a podcast about it because it exists in the world. And it just becomes easier to find games that represent the specific thing that you want. But I think that we're still going to, I would hope we find ways to make those games easier to find, which means that I hope DriveThruRPG's search engine gets better. Because I hope the future of role-playing games.
Do you see a lot more stuff on itch.io?
Itch seems to be the next, the big thing. And I'm super excited to see that Itch is like blowing up in the tabletop space, because it's easy to find. Like they have their interface, their ability for you to make your own storefront. I hope that that people making tabletop games continue to flock there and to similar places as a place to make and sell your things, because I think Itch has really made it easy, and I think that is an invaluable process. Or an invaluable thing is to have an easy way for me to make a thing, put it in front of you for you to purchase the thing or just to download it, and then for us to have like that connection. And I think that is unbelievably important.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Like it's really cool. Like the current design scene, I guess, is a phrase I have to use, is really amazing and like next level and innovative and amazing. But like, I can't deny that's totally inaccessible, laughably inaccessible. So if there can be something like...
It's hard to find the stuff that you're playing, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And like, there's been times when I've talked really excitedly about a game and someone's like, oh, I want that. Where can I get that? And I'm like, I truly don't know. I have no idea. I can't believe I played it.
I've been there. I have games on my hard drive that I do not know where they came from. I don't know where I found them. I don't know what I was looking for. I have games that I'm like, oh, I love this game. I may have just physically, like mentally manifested this, some kind of like it's a good day, like psychic power thing where I just willed it into being. So yeah, finding things, I think, is where I would hope where the future holds, is making it easier to find stuff.
I think that's a good intention to set for the future. And whoever figures out the way to do that will not make any money, but they will be probably not recognized. But they will be doing a good thing. And they can know that and hold that in their hearts. Now, Jeff, we've been dancing around this all interview, but it's time to really talk about what I feel is one of the most important issues facing live action design right now. And that is the refusal of the Olive Garden to recognize your LARP, when you're here, your family, as the official Olive Garden LARP. How do you feel about this?
There has been a wrong dealt to me and my family. And I would like justice. Justice is what I would enjoy more than anything. I just want the Darden family of restaurants to make things right for me and for my loved ones. by declaring me the official LARP designer of the Olive Garden restaurant, giving me a $15 Olive Garden gift card that is the approximate value of one person's unlimited soup, salad, and breadsticks lunch plus a soda. I will cover tip. An Olive Garden hat or t-shirt. I do not need both. And access to their InDesign files such that I may make the official PDF look like an Olive Garden menu.
Right. And these are simple demands. None of this is, you know, is too burdensome. And so what have your interactions with this corporation been like so far with the brand?
Silence. Radio silence. Not a word. Not a word from the Olive. The closest we have gotten to any sort of official designated response from the Olive Garden was one of the players of the Olive Garden LARP had commented that they only got through two courses of soup, salad, and some breadsticks. And they said, I think that makes my society a loser. And the Olive Garden responded, we don't think you're a loser. This has been the only official communication that has come from the Olive Garden restaurant.
Wow. Ambiguous. Mysterious.
You gotta wonder how much they know. Because it sounded like they really understood the conversation.
It's true. But that could just be this marketing automation thing I've heard so much about.
Could be. I have many questions. And I would love for them to get back to me.
Many questions, few answers. And but it just seems like there's been a groundswell of support for you here in the community.
There has been. I've been very flattered. I'm very flattered that people that when you're here, your family has resonated with people within the community, and that people have not only like played the game and talked about the game and felt the game, you know, felt the game in a part of themselves, but that very few of them has angrily told me that I am an advertising bot for the Olive Garden.
Few?
And that few, not none, but few.
Okay, I'm going to need you to expand on that.
I had just, you know, I had got, there was, I think there was exactly one comment that just said, yeah, this is an ad, this doesn't matter. And I was like, ow. Kind of
wow.
I mean, I guess it technically is an ad for the Olive Garden, but that hurts a little bit that you don't think that I am genuine in writing my game.
So I haven't played it. I have to, you know, own up to that. But I have read it, and
so we're done here.
It's I've heard reports from Kotaku.com that you haven't played it.
Wow, I did not think I was going to get called. This is one of them famous Alex Roberts gotcha questions.
I'm a hard-hitting journalist, and, you know, this is, it's just my, I'm just doing my job.
That's fair. This is the Frost Nixon of LARP podcasts is what's happening here.
Yep, that's what I was thinking from the get-go. They talked about wrestling a lot, too.
They did. They did. I have not played it. It was written strictly theoretically, and perhaps, I think maybe, like, here's the tough position that I'm in, is I think maybe if I were to play it, the Olive Garden might finally, like, you know, acknowledge me, but I don't think I should have to pay money for their approval.
Right. Right. You know, we're all trying to make a living, you know, we're all trying to, you know, artists deserve to be compensated for their labor. Disregard everything we said earlier about people throwing up 3Art and it being great. You know, you're a professional and I think that's,
and I deserve my $15 gift card
and hat or t-shirt.
Hat or t-shirt. One or the other. I don't need both. I don't want to look like a shill.
Oh, I gotta edit out all my laughs so this seems more deadpan. But speaking of deadpan, like I have read this LARP, and the thing is, like, it doesn't read like a joke. Like, it, I think it's actually, you know, it is about family, and it's this like multi-generational story about coming to a new place and, you know, your relationship to the previous generation. It's this immigrant story. It's actually very compelling.
So as soon as I knew that I was going to write this game, which the story is, I was asked to write this game as a joke. And as soon as someone posited to me that I could be working on a project as a joke, I said, oh no, oh no, no, no. You misunderstand. Because if I work on this, it's going to be extremely serious. And like, as soon as I had started doing this, I was like, oh, I definitely want to make this like the most morally complex, like the most like, you know, real, like the realest possible thing so that you could initially say, oh, it's that Olive Garden LARP. But then you read it and you're like, wait, why am I feeling feelings about an Olive Garden LARP?
What I actually think is most interesting and that we could probably spend the most time talking about is pacing and rhythm. Because that's actually one of, like, those are two of the biggest challenges in live action design and to a certain extent in tabletop design as well, is giving people an experience that you have some control over the pacing of, right? And how they digest it. When you give them all of the information up front and you need that to be conveyed without you in the room, how do you control the flow of that? And so by tying in the generation, like the generational experience to each successive round of unlimited soup, salad, and breadsticks. Yeah, where did that come from? Was that an immediate thing? Were you thinking about pacing or did it just kind of sui generis, like, oh, that'd be cool?
So it was very specific. So the joke prompt that I received was write a LARP to be played at an Olive Garden. And so I wasn't even necessarily thinking of pacing. What I, like, the specific thing that I was really thinking of, kind of the challenge I had given myself was, if it had, like, it was something that could only be done at an Olive Garden, which meant that it had to meaningfully involve soup salad, like their unlimited soup, salad, and breadsticks promotion, because it's the only thing that I know about the Olive Garden. It's the only concrete thing that I can say that is definitely a thing that the Olive Garden has that I can't go to another restaurant for. And so I had said, okay, so how do I meaningfully make this? How do I meaningfully say this has to be, like, within the core mechanic of the game is soup, salad, is being delivered soup, salad, and breadsticks. And so that's kind of where the pacing thing came from, is I was like, okay, if I'm thinking about eating at the Olive Garden, eating a successive rounds of soup and then salad and then getting breadsticks brought to me as I eat them, it kind of naturally comes to that moment of like, okay, this has to be a thing to control pace, because it has to be the thing that, because it is a thing that you can reliably say, okay, so after about this amount of time, you will be given more food. And so it kind of naturally tied into that. And then the other half of that being, I immediately knew that I knew the only other thing about the Olive Garden that I really knew it had to happen, and it turns out they no longer use this catchphrase, as I've learned, which might be why they're not answering my tweets.
You're off brand.
I might be off brand. That might be the problem. But their tagline is and was, when you're here, you're family. So I said, okay, it has to meaningfully involve family, but it has to be morally complicated. It can't just be a loving family picture, because that's an Olive Garden commercial. It has to be a difficult family that, like, you're disappointed in your parents and your parents are disappointed in you. And you look back at their generation's values and you say, what were you thinking? How could you do that? And it creates this complicated web of people breaking from tradition and saying, like, I am not going to follow in your footsteps. And sort of the entire game swirled into peace from there of like, okay, so then that's an immigrant story in itself, right? It's like, I don't want to do what my parents did, so I'm going to a new place. I'm starting over. My children will look at things that I did and say, like, why can't you more accurately fulfill, like, the values of the time? And then their children will look at them and think the same thing until such a time that somebody else says, I'm going to leave this place. Like, it is a narrative that ties very nicely into all of those things. Also, it's really funny if the Olive Garden LARP is super, super serious.
Yeah, that's the funniest thing. And I appreciate that kind of prioritization. I'm just going to take a quick second to find out what the Olive Garden's new slogan is. I'm being invited to join the Olive Garden E-Club, which I think would actually be a good venue for your game. You know, that could be a newsletter exclusive. That's good content.
Yeah, they could distribute it. That it's all right. We're adding that to the list of demands. Olive Garden, you could have jumped on it beforehand, but now the stakes have been risen, and I expect you to distribute the PDF of my LARP to your entire e-club after you give me access to the InDesign files, such that I might make it look like an Olive Garden menu.
I'm seeing actually a lot of sort of, short, compelling copy here on the website, including now there's even more at Olive Garden, which, I don't know, family is ... at Olive Garden.
Family is also a really good name for the LARP, though.
You know what? You're right. Family is complicated.
According to Wikipedia, the new company slogan started in early 2013 is "We're all family here," which seems very similar to "When you're here, you're family." So I'm not really sure why the change happened.
Maybe it implies sort of like a broader relationship with the brand, right? Like when you leave the restaurant, your relationship to Olive Garden remains, you know?
That's a good point. That's a really good point.
Wow. Finding out kind of a lot about this brand and its values. And also just looking at like a lot of melted cheese.
Yeah. Yeah. You're gonna do that if you're at the Olive Garden website. That's just going to happen.
Oh, when I'm here, I'm queasy. Okay. All right. Closing that tab. But I feel like we've learned a lot. And, you know, my final question for you is, would you accept the recognition of the Olive Garden if it required you to change your art?
That's a really good and difficult question. I don't think I would. I think the Olive Garden can accept me for who I am and for what I have made. That's because, frankly, like, the work that I've made deserves its recognition on its own. If the Olive Garden thinks that they can make a better LARP, if the Olive Garden thinks that they can make better work, they're free. They can feel free to do that. I challenge them to do that. If they think that my work does not deserve their recognition and they think that they can make a better LARP, I invite them to try. But I think that the work that I've presented has connected with people in a way that I think they would be better off just acknowledging me for what and acknowledging the work for what it is and say, oh, wow, you've created a meaningful thing based on our family of mid-sized chain restaurants.
It's a very, very strong statement. And I think it's one that will resonate with a lot of creators listening. So thank you very much for sharing that. Yeah. GM Jeff Stormer, thank you so much for joining us here on the program. If any of my listeners want to get at you, hear what you're up to, follow your projects, maybe join the campaign for the recognition of the official Olive Garden LARP, where can they find you?
They can find me. The best place is probably on Twitter at Party of One Pod. There you can find links to all of my projects. You can find, if you just search for Olive Garden LARP on Twitter, mine is the first result on the top tab. The tweet in which I unveiled the LARP to the Olive Garden and asked them for my title. But follow me on Twitter. JeffStormer.com also has links to all of my podcasting stuff, my game design stuff. And that's pretty much it in a nutshell. Let's see. I do several podcasts, the notable one being Party of One, which is about two-player role-playing games. They can find that at PartyOfOnePodcast.com.
Right. And don't forget All My Fantasy Children, which is...
Also, All My Fantasy Children, which is a character creation, storytelling, and world-building podcast powered by listener prompts and is a precious baby that I love with all of my heart.
It's a good time. It's a very good time. And you can certainly go on, I think, Twitter. Is that where you're still accepting prompts?
Yes, we accept prompts on Twitter, Facebook, the website, allmyfantasychildren.com. Basically, what we ask is you send us an idea for a character, and then every week, my best friend Aaron Catano, Saez, and I take a prompt from wherever we get them and... basically create a character, like a role-playing game character or a non-player character or a piece of the fictional world of fantasy. And we kind of spin it out of that prompt and we're building out this shared universe one piece at a time.
It's fun. It's a fun thing to participate in. It just occurs to me right now that we could have spent this entire time talking about two-player role-playing games, but we didn't, you know, and that's a choice that we made. And I'm okay with that.
I would like to ask you a question real quick. What's a two-player game that you are really fascinated with right now at this moment that you would like me or the listeners at home to know about?
Oh, gosh. Right now, Bjarke Pedersen and Lizzie Stark are in the process of making a two-player game called To the Bitter End, where you play out kind of the full story of a relationship between people, and there's card prompts. But, like, it includes... you know, the first date and, you know, like the meet cute and their time together and then building this really beautiful relationship. And it also includes like a really nasty, awful breakup. And the cards that you draw early on are all these, you know, expressions of interest and expressions of love. And then, but by the time you get to the end of the deck, the card prompts that you get are like, sigh. And like, if your partner tries to touch your hand, jerk it away really quickly. And just all this really like devastating stuff. But it really does kind of tell the totality. And it's not like a total bummer of a game. It's a lot of like very relatable content. Like one of the cards is like, tell your partner when identifying a thing that they did that they always do that. And it's, oh my gosh, no. Yeah. So it's a very smart design. They're making it very like paceable so that you can play for like, you know, 2 hours or like down to half an hour or whatever. It's a really cool design and I'm hoping that they will share it widely.
I love that. That sounds amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's going to be pretty cool.
Thank you for that. I'm very excited about that. I figured if we should at least briefly touch on the subject. So thank you for indulging me in that.
Thanks. I feel like I've talked a lot this interview.
I feel like the same. So I feel like that means that it's a good balanced interview.
Thank you, Jeff. So yeah, people should go and listen to your podcasts and they should follow you on Twitter where you make good tweets. They should, you know, join the fight for recognition. And I think shortly after this podcast goes up, you're going to have a Kickstarter launching?
Yes, I will be running a Kickstarter for Mission Accomplished, which is a role-playing game of super spies and office meetings, inspired very much by TV shows like Archer or The Venture Brothers, games like Fiasco and Paranoia, and movies like Rashomon, which is sort of out of the spy genre, but it's the right thing for the game. Find that on Kickstarter starting October 16th, and I'm very excited about it.
Awesome. Well, yeah. Thanks for joining me. This is great. I feel like we actually covered everything. We just kind of...
I feel like we hit it.
We just kind of shoved a bunch of stuff towards the back. Well, thanks again to Jeff for joining us, and as always, thank you for listening. Remember that if you have thoughts on today's episode, you can always email me, that's backstorypodcast@gmail.com, or you can get at me on Twitter, @backstorycast. Backstory is part of the One Shot Podcast Network. You can go to oneshotpodcast.com and check out our snazzy new website, and find more great RPG-related shows like Adventure. Adventure is an actual play podcast that focuses on the fun of fanfiction, and is set in your favorite fictional universes. Join host Pranks Paul as he takes a variety of guests through self-contained stories featuring Harry Potter, Pokemon, Animorphs, and many other favorites. Again, that's oneshotpodcast.com. Music for Backstory is provided by Ujiko. The track is called Thinkin' of You, and you can hear more at soundcloud.com/ujico, or find them on YouTube or Spotify or wherever else you get your chill beats. Talk to you later, friends.